The gospel reading is from Luke chapter 7, verses 1 through 10. After Jesus had finished all his sayings in the hearings of the people, he entered Capernaum. A centurion there had a slave whom he valued highly and who was ill and close to death. When he heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders to him, asking him to come and heal his slave. When they came to Jesus, they appealed to him earnestly, saying, "He is worthy of having you do this for him, for he loves our people, and it is he who built our synagogue." And Jesus went with them. But when he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to say to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you, but only speak the word, and let my servant be healed. For I also am a man set under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes, and to my slave, 'Do this,' and the slave does it." When Jesus heard this, he was amazed, and turning to the crowd that followed him, he said, "I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith." When those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the slave in good health. The Gospel of the Lord. You may be seated. So, faithfulness. What is faithfulness? Most of us know it when we see it, right? Loyalty, steadfastness, steadily remaining, being true. It's not maybe the most exciting fruit out there, is it? Until you think about that faithful fan who follows his or her team from losing season to losing season to losing season, never giving up. Faithfulness. So where do we start? Well, faithfulness starts with faith, of course. We put our faith in God. We trust God, God who loves us, who cares for us, who makes us new in our baptism, this God. But then faithfulness is the next step. It's putting that faith into action. How do we do that? To faithfulness. Okay, so the Godfather movies show us one form of faithfulness. I know these are kind of old, but most of us know them. In the very first movie, the very first scene, Don Corleone has a man who has come to him seeking justice for his daughter who was injured. He has something he wants Don Corleone to do for him. Now, they go back and forth quite a bit with Don Corleone reminding him that he hasn't really been that faithful to him. He's not even called him Godfather. But they finally come to an agreement. And Don Corleone, "Someday, and that day may never come, I will ask you to do a service for me. But until that day, consider this a gift on my daughter's wedding day." The Romans had a system very similar to this. It's the patron-client system, and it went all throughout Roman society, from the emperor down to the poorest of the poor, and even included freed slaves after a while. The system works this way. You have a patron and a client. The patron is usually the wealthier person, the person in power, or has greater prestige than the client. The patron is meant to be a benefactor, to protect the client, perhaps to assist them in legal matters, or even help them make a better marriage. The client, then, offers service to the patron. And one of the things they did is what's kind of shown in this painting here. Every morning, early in the morning, the client was supposed to show up at the house of the patron, wish him good morning. The patron would give them some gifts, usually food or perhaps a little bit of money. And then when the patron left his house, the clients would follow the streets of Rome, telling everybody they met what a great guy he was. So as they prayed through here, they're just telling him he does this wonderful thing and that wonderful thing all day long. And then at the end of the day, if they're really lucky and they've done a super job, the patron might actually invite you in for dinner. And then the next day you get up and you do the same thing again and again. It's easy to imagine how this quickly turned in from a relationship to a transaction. So Jesus has just finished giving his Sermon on the Mount, or Sermon on the Plain in Luke, which we recognize as it has the blessing, the woes. We'll remember the love your enemies, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And he comes into Capernaum where Peter and Andrew, James and John live, and also this centurion. Now the centurion would have been a Roman soldier, but the reason he's likely in Capernaum is that is the territory of Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas is the son of Herod the Great from the Nativity story. And he, when he died, his kingdom was divided up into pieces. And the Romans, of course, own all of this. They occupy it. They've taken it over. And Antipas. Herod Antipas is what was called a client king, with the emperor of Rome being his patron. So the centurion owes allegiance to the emperor of Rome, but also to Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas owns allegiance by giving them tribute, which he's collected in the form of taxes from the people. And he receives this army for protection, as well as he's king. So the whole system is working really well, and this centurion is going to be allegiant to both Herod Antipas, but even more greatly to the emperor of Rome. And he has a slave whom he values highly, perhaps loves this slave. The slave has some skills, or that over time they've become friends. And he values this slave enough that when he hears about Jesus, who can heal, he wants Jesus to heal a slave. So he gets together the Jewish elders and sends them to Jesus, telling him, and the Jewish elders tell Jesus, he's a great guy. He built our synagogue for us. He loves our people. And right away, you can see even out here on the edge of the Roman Empire, the patron-client system is working well. The Jewish elders are acting as the clients to the centurion, as the patron, and they're going to help this transaction go forward because he's done a lot for them. He's protected them. He's built their synagogue. And they owe him service. Maybe that's faithfulness. Maybe it's a transaction. My husband got the last driver's license, so I had a card, a driver. And my driver, this is not him, but I didn't have great pictures of him, so. But he would take me places, and there was a lot to learn when we first got to China, a whole lot. One of the things that we had to learn was a phrase called mei wan ti, which everybody used, and it means no problem. Now, if you just heard the mayo, there's a joke that went around called hold the mayo, because mayo means there might be a problem. But mei wan ti is there's no problem. So everybody used it. It was one of the first ones you pick up. I was going shopping one day, and he was taking me to the place where I was going to shop. And when I get out of the car, I would always say, well, let's meet back at such and such a place at such and such a time. And usually the answer was, mei wan ti, no problem. This day, he said, there may be a problem. Well, hey, in my American understanding, there was no problem. I knew the time, I knew the place, I knew the people. Nope, it's fine, we'll be here. And he said, maybe a problem. And I said, no problem, maybe a problem. So I went off to do my shopping, and I came back to the place where I was to meet him at the time we were going to meet, and I waited. And I waited. And I waited. And here comes the car and Lao Jin. Everything's fine. I get in the car. I had forgotten another important piece of Chinese culture called saving face. In Chinese culture, you don't say no. If you say no, you lose face. It's great dishonor on you to say no. But if you push someone to the point where they feel like they have to say no, and they say no, you also lose face. So Lao Jin, by refusing, knew he wasn't going to be there at that time, was saving my face, my honor. He was protecting me. Jesus goes along with the elders, and he doesn't get very far, and soon come some friends. Fascinating that an occupying Roman army officer would have friends in the neighborhood. I mean, it tells you a lot about him, doesn't it? Now, they may be Gentile friends, but some were probably Jewish friends as well. And he says, "Lord, I didn't even bother coming to you. I'm not worthy." He's not playing the patron-client game at all. Where they have been saying he's worthy, do this for him, he's saying, "I am not worthy. That is not the way this is going to go. We're not going to do this quid pro quo thing. We're moving it somewhere else." He is protecting Jesus' honor. What would happen is Jesus, as a Jewish rabbi, could become unclean just by coming in contact with a Gentile, but even more so if he goes under his roof. Because if he goes under his roof, the Roman centurion is obligated to offer him hospitality. And there's certain rules that go with hospitality in this culture, one of which is you must offer food and drink. Well, the food may not be kosher. In fact, the Roman army officer would likely be involved in offering stuff to the Roman gods, because they had a great patron-client relationship with the gods. You offer them stuff, and then you win a military victory. If you don't, you didn't offer them enough stuff, so go offer them some more. The food may have been offered to idols before it came to his table. And Jesus, as a guest, was obligated to accept whatever was put in front of him to eat or drink. So the Roman centurion, by not having come to his house, is taking care of protecting Jesus and really giving him the greater honor. We talked about the service dogs a little bit, and service dogs, of course, have one master that they obey, and they obey their training, and they obey their master. They don't mess around. They are under the authority of their master. Even if there's chickens in the room, they must not go after those chickens. They must not go after anything that is not relevant to their job. The centurion gives a statement of faith in Jesus when he says, "Say the word, and my servant will be healed." Give the command. That's it. How can he be so sure? And he explains then how he's so sure. He says, "I am a man under authority, and I have others under me." And he's not kidding. He was a centurion, which means he had about 100 people under his authority. But a century was part of a cohort. There was usually six centuries in a cohort. And then a cohort is part of a legion. And there's 10 cohorts in a legion, so we're talking 6,000 people. And at any given time, Rome had between 25 and 34 legions. That's more math than I can do. They had to be, the authority had to be strict. So the emperor was the ultimate authority, and then it goes down through the generals. This centurion had cohort commanders over him, he had legion commanders over him, he had whoever else was next over him, all the way up to the emperor. And he had people under him. And they all had to have enough faith to obey the commands of each other. The people under had to have faith that the people given the commands knew what the heck they were talking about. And the people giving the commands had to trust that the people under them would actually obey the commands. And if any one of them doesn't do it, the battle could be lost, the war could be lost, and the empire could fall. Jesus is amazed at this centurion and his understanding. Just give the command, Jesus, and it will be so. We have a friend, Andrea, who's a missionary in Hungary. She's Hungarian by birth, but came here, became a U.S. citizen, married, had children. Her husband's also Hungarian. She has two children, both of whom have special needs. Her husband took a new job back in Hungary, and they moved back, where she discovered that there is no special education program at all, none. And not only that, her children now are having to learn in a foreign language, to them, a more foreign language, because they're more English speaking. So she started studying up. She learned enough about special ed to maybe homeschool. Then she found out there was an international school there that catered to missionaries and to other people who wanted to come and learn English that lived in Hungary. So she went on and got her teaching certification to be able to teach special education in this school. She has to raise all of her own funding for the school, but she now teaches in the missionary school special education to children who come from all over the world, and even children who come from the Hungarian school system into that school system because there is special education available. When you talk to her, she tells you about God's faithfulness through this whole process towards her. See, God's faithfulness is here for us all the time. No matter what, no matter when, God is faithful to us day after day, moment after moment, second after second, for our entire lives and beyond, whether we are paying attention and noticing it or not. But sometimes we do notice it. And when we do, it is amazing. And we see our faith grow and we watch our faithfulness, fruit of the Spirit, just blossom, bloom, and fruit all the way out. We grow in thanksgiving and we grow in returning faithfulness to God. Being faithful means putting our faith into action. Our trust in God towards God. We become more faithful towards God. And our trust in God that He has called us out to be faithful to others. Faithful in service, faithful in love, faithful in joy, all the fruits of the Spirit. Faithful to God and all of God's creation. See, faithfulness is a long-term project. You're in it for the long haul. He was faithful to his slave. He was faithful to his nation. He was faithful to the Jewish people. He was faithful to Jesus. He was faithful to God. And all of that before his servant was healed. Go in faith.